slow down. I'm always burning my tires and my horn is too loud. I catch people staring, looking funny at me when I step to the window and I toss the TV. Sometimes I get crazy and it makes a big scene, but when I hit 21, I wanna stand up and scream. I'm filthy rich with laughter, I'm too big for the room. You know, from two stories up, a zenith makes a big boom. It's hard to get around in a 6-foot town when you're 10 feet tall. Everything's so small. I'm always bumping my head. I'm way too long for the bed. Yeah, it's hard to get around in a 6-foot town. Inside a tiny little box, they're preoccupied about mismatching their socks. Well, I've never been one to worry about much. I just wanna laugh and love, I just wanna live it up. But it's hard to get around in a 6-foot town when you're 10 feet tall. Everything is so small. I'm always bumping my head. I'm way too long for the bed. Yeah, it's hard to get
town. Welcome in, everybody. Great to be with you once again. Thank you so much for joining me for the relaunch. I know that we're behind schedule, but I gotta tell you, there have been so many problems since I've been away from the studio for a month. Everything's reconfigured. I had to redo all the stuff, so technical issues abound, but it's okay. We were able to get on the air to bring you this broadcast, and I got to tell you, there is so much news that I've missed out on. There's been so long since I've actually had a chance to talk with you about some of the issues going on, not only nationally, but especially going on right here at the state, at the local level, that I'm really, really glad that we were able to pull this off. First and foremost of all, I did have a little trouble wondering what I was going to wear for the big relaunch, and then, of course, yesterday, that was basically decided for me. I had to represent my Auburn Tigers, so congratulations to them, SEC champions, when it comes to the basketball, men's basketball. So we did a really good job. Those guys just absolutely played their hearts out, and I could not be more proud of them. I think a 5 seed was a little low. Honestly, I was expecting to be bumped up to a 4 seed after winning against Tennessee, and not just beating Tennessee, but winning in very convincing fashion. I really thought that, you know, Auburn was going to get at least a 4 seed after that. But nonetheless, you know, the tournament is coming up. I'm going to be looking forward to it, watching the Auburn Tigers play for that, and that is something that I'm very excited about. And some people are so excited about this whole thing that they don't do a great job of spell checking themselves. So this comes from CBS 42, which is up in Birmingham. They apparently didn't do a great job of checking, because if you look at the title there, Auburn wins sex tournament. So the thing is, I think we've all run into this before. If you're an SEC fan and you talk sports with your friends on the phone, that either your phone doesn't autocorrect or you just spell check gets you or something like that. That's what this looks like to me. I looked at that. I was like, oh gosh, some intern in Birmingham just got fired. You had one job. But Auburn winning the sex tournament, that was a big deal, apparently. I'm sure, actually, our friend Rick Hendrick over at 95.1 The Fox, he found the same photo and commented on it. He's like, I'm guessing that enrollment at Auburn just skyrocketed. I guess you could put that on your resume, that you were a student athlete, technically, and you won a tournament, but that's not the kind of tournament you want to hear about. I do think we've all run into that, though. If you're talking to your friends on, you know, some kind of sporting event talking about the SEC championship and the autocorrect, and you don't catch it, so you send it before you actually got a chance to correct it. And I think we've all been in that situation before, but it is funny that this guy making essentially that same mistake is just one letter off. It made TV, at least here locally, which I thought was just incredibly amusing. But congratulations to the Auburn Tigers, and I'm really going to look forward to seeing them play. And Alabama made the NIT, so they're going to be able to play in that as well. So Auburn, of course, being sort of more in the spotlight this year because of their accomplishments in basketball. But when it comes to local news, I wish everything were this chipper. And one thing that I have made it a point to talk about today, and we're going to be spending the bulk, if not the entirety, of the show on this topic because it is so important. It is something that has been really water cooler talk around the state, even if you're not a political guy. Like a lot of people that are not like you watching a show about politics, a lot of people are talking about this even if they're not political geeks or they're normally not paying attention to it. And the reason is because the gas tax that just passed has really captured everybody's attention. And that makes sense because the average citizen is going to directly wind up paying for this in a very obvious way. And that's part of the reason that you're seeing the sort of upheaval is the best way to put it over this. Now, there are a lot more people in favor of it than I originally thought there would be. But the point is, this has become actually a pretty hot topic when it comes to debate, just the average person, not necessarily somebody that's a political phenom, somebody that is, you know, really dialed in to what is going on in politics, especially state politics. But this has really captured people's attention. And I think that it should. I mean, we're looking at a substantial tax increase. And there are several things that are going out there. There's a lot of information, a lot of misinformation. So we're going to try to kind of sort through that and give you an idea. I hate that I was unfortunately had to be away from my microphone for all this time while a lot of this was going on because, of course, it already passed. It's actually signed by the governor and now it's law. But, I mean, it was not really hard to miss that window because there was very little debate. It just kind of sailed through. We're going to talk about that as well. So there's a few questions that I think are really, really important for us to ask about this gas tax. And one of them is, what all does the gas tax include? That really should be the first question that everybody asks. Because if you're interested in this, the first thing you want to know is, okay, what is it going to do? How does this affect me? And there's a couple of things that we need to be aware of on this. First of all, the obvious thing, the big thing that everybody's talking about is the increase in the gas tax itself. So the way that that works is there is going to be a 6-cent immediate tax hike. So right away, you're going to see 6 cents more in the price of your gas. And then that is gradually going to get larger as time goes on. Is going to be that original 6 cents. And then you're going to have two added on for 3 years. I guess the last year there's only one that's mandated because obviously, you're going to see that, and then it's going to go from 6 to 8, from 8 to 10, and then here's another thing that a lot of people aren't aware of. That's the bare minimum. Your gas taxes are going to go up 10 cents in 3 years, no matter what. However, there is going to be possible increases in future taxes. So currently, the gas tax sits at 18%. I think it's actually 18.4, but, you know, roughly 18%. And that makes this, at the end of those 3 years, a 55% increase. This is a substantial increase in the gas tax. It's going to jump from 18 to 28. That's a pretty big leap. And another thing that is going on here is this includes a annual 2-cent increase per year as long as inflation continues to rise. And if the trends in the past have been any indication of what the future is going to look like, inflation is going to continue to be something that is an issue. Now, I don't know that it's going to be as much of an issue now that President Trump is in office, because with Obama, you had two giant quantitative easing measures. And without getting into the weeds and explaining where all that is, because I've actually already done that on the show previously a while back when those things were going on. So the quantitative easing was basically printing money. The particular way that they did it was more printing digital money. But since a lot of money is digital now, I mean, when was the last time you actually paid for something in cash? Then printing digital money was really no different than printing paper money. And when you have a larger supply of money out there, the cost goes down, which means that things cost more money. Or sorry, the cost doesn't go down. The value of money goes down, which results in an increase in cost of goods. So what they're essentially saying is, as long as inflation continues to rise, this gas tax is also going to continue to rise. And this was evidently the plan all along. So you're not just getting the 10-cent increase at the end of 3 years. You've got a 6-cent immediately, and then you're going to get 10 cents at the end of 3 years. That's guaranteed no matter what happens. But then you will also see taxes increase on top of that amount as long as inflation continues to increase. So really, the limits of where this gas tax could go, we could theoretically, and I don't think that this is all that far-fetched, see a 2-cent increase in gas taxes every year from now on. I mean, think about that. And it would not be very hard to imagine inflation continuing in the United States. It's been on an upward trend for a while now. And so we could see a 2-cent increase in gas taxes every single year. I mean, for 50, 100 years, there is no limit on how long this thing can go. So that's what we're looking at right now, because there is no sunset clause on that. It keeps going. It keeps going north. And eventually, I mean, it's there is no limit to how much this tax can actually cost the gas users of the state of Alabama. And another thing that was interesting that a lot of people don't know about is it also causes an increase in your registration and your tags. So whatever you're paying for your tags or your registration now, that price is going to go up. You're going to see an increase in that. And it's the last I checked, it was a pretty substantial increase. There's a little bit of a, I don't remember whether this was the final bill or this was the bill that was presented before the final bill, which means I don't remember exactly what the rate was, but I'm believing it was somewhere close to 30%. So you're seeing a substantial increase in your registration fee, your tags, whatever you're paying for. Basically, anything that has anything remotely to do with your car just got more expensive thanks to the Alabama House, the Alabama Senate, and the governor passing this whole thing through in about 3 days. And another thing, too, that a lot of people aren't aware of, that a lot of people don't really know about, is that if you happen to have a hybrid car. So if you happen to have a hybrid car, you happen to have an electric car, your registration is going to cost more. So if you are driving a hybrid, you get a $100 annual fee. If you're driving an electric car, in other words, you don't put any gas in it, you just plug it in and electricity is the only place it gets power from, that's $200. So if you were under the false impression that somehow the government was going to allow you to save money, you were sadly mistaken. Because that's what's going to happen here. If you bought a car and spent a little extra money on it, let's say you got a Chevy Volt or something like that, or the Nissan Leaf. Let's say you bought one of those cars and you're like, okay, I'm going to save money on gas. No, you're not either. The state of Alabama is going to get theirs one way or the other. And here's another thing too. And there is a discrepancy here as well. We were told by Senator Clyde Chambliss, who was a co-sponsor of this bill, and others, that, well, it's only going to cost $55 a year. The average person, it's only going to cost you $55 a year annually. Oh, really? So why then is the cost for having a hybrid car $100 and a electric car $200? Because an electric car, of course, doesn't use gas, and their justification is, well, okay, this car doesn't use gas, but it still uses the roads, so we're going to need to get that money from them some kind of way, and that's why we have the fee. Well, then why are you charging them almost four times what a normal gas user is going to use? Or for a hybrid car who is going to still be paying at least some in gas, his car uses less gas, but it still uses it, why are you charging them $100? Here's the thing. The lawmakers know that this isn't actually going to cost you about $55 a year. They know it's going to be somewhere between $100 and $200, and they are making sure they get theirs. They're making sure that if you want to buy a hybrid car, there is no way for you to avoid taxes. And that's kind of the default of the government every time anyway, isn't it? Isn't that just kind of the way that government goes? That they essentially set it up in such a way that they're going to tax you for doing X. And if there is all of a sudden a market way for you to save money, then they're going to say, no, you don't. See, They try to give this impression that they want you to be, you know, quote unquote, environmentally conscious. I would argue that an electric or hybrid car isn't necessarily all that great for the environment unless you use it for upwards to about 10 years. That's when the payoff starts because they're more expensive to build. It takes more CO2 emissions to actually get them built and manufactured. So there's a little bit of discretion there. Let's just put that aside for a second. The governments usually tell us, well, we want you to be environmentally conscious. We want you to use less energy. Okay, well, if you do that and you comply with it, then all of a sudden they say, oh, well, that's actually going to cost us taxes. In other words, we're not going to be able to collect taxes from you as much because you're saving money. We're going to have to come after you for that. They've done the same thing with solar panels. Not in the state of Alabama, but there are several states that were urging people, okay, we're going to give you tax credits for putting solar panels on your house, and you're going to be able to save all this money. And then all of a sudden they realize, revenues for taxes on electricity are going down. We got to fix that. See, that's the thing. People in the government are constantly trying to figure out new and creative ways to get your money away from you. And unfortunately, the lawmakers in Alabama are no different. They're doing exactly the same thing with hybrid and electric vehicles. And they another thing that kind of bothers me about this, and I'm not, you know, a huge electric vehicle fan. For goodness sake, I drive a Dodge Ram 1500. Like, I'm not necessarily someone who wants to purchase an electric vehicle myself, but I do feel for those that did and wanted to save a little bit of money because they're getting royally screwed on this. Because when you're looking at this electric vehicle that they're now going to be paying $100 or $200 every single year to compensate the state of Alabama for them not driving a gasoline power, or at least not a primarily gasoline powered car, well, they're going to see their revenue. They're going to see basically the same amount of taxes from this, unless you also factor in that the electricity is also taxed. And obviously somebody that powers their car with electricity is going to be using a lot more of it. So the point is, regardless of the way you look at this, you're getting taxed twice. You're getting taxed for, if you drive a hybrid, you're getting taxed for the electricity, you're getting taxed for the gasoline, and then you're getting taxed when you register your car, paying that $100 fee. Or if you're just using a pure electric car, you're paying the taxes on the electricity and then paying $200 to the state of Alabama just for having an electric car. And so I really do feel for these guys, because the whole point of getting these more expensive energy-saving cars was that you didn't have to deal with this stuff, and now the state of Alabama is going to charge you extra money anyway. It really is horrible. And by the way, if you do want to call in, I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on this. I'd love to hear what some of the citizens think. 860-1440 is the way to do that, or you can tweet me at Tactics Radio. You can do that anytime, and we'll try to get those on the show. So there's a couple things here. Senator Clyde Chambliss, he claimed that in a study that they did and tried to factor up exactly how much this tax was going to cost. They said that it was only going to cost the average Alabamian about $55 a year. I just alluded to that a second ago. That was sort of the line that all the politicians were putting up, is that the state of Alabama They were only going to $55 a year was the amount that they were saying it was going to about average out to $55. Here's the problem with that, though, because I was trying to figure out where did they get that figure? Because I was doing all the calculations myself, and I didn't come anywhere near $55 a year. And so I was trying to figure out how did they wire work it to make the number so low? Well, it turns out in 2017, the University of Kansas had a study that showed that Alabama consumes about $2.72 billion of gasoline a year. Or sorry, billion gallons, not dollars. So 2.72 billion gallons of gas a year from the state of Alabama. Well, if you divide the state if you divide that by the state population, which last I checked is about 4.888 million, it comes out to roughly $55 a year. I think it was actually like 56.4, but my point is what they did was they just took the entire population of Alabama and then divided the gallons of gasoline we use every year by that and then factored in the 10 cents and then it comes up to right around $55 a year. Okay, that's not a terrible method except for one thing. You're assuming that every single citizen of the state of Alabama uses roughly the same amount of gasoline. That's not true. Because a large portion of the citizens of the state of Alabama are children who cannot drive yet. So if you're under the age of 16, you're probably not buying gas. And let's be honest, if you're under 16, unless you actually do have a part-time job or something, you're probably not paying for your own gas then either. And so a better way to figure this up and figure up about how much it's going to cost you as an individual is divide... if you're going to do that, you have to look at about how much gas you use personally. Because like I said, this statistic is factoring in children. It's also factoring in elderly people that may only drive somewhere once or twice a week. It's also factoring in, prisoners that can't drive anywhere. Every person in the state of Alabama is being counted in that figure. And it's not a good way to figure that up because you're not averaging what it's going to cost the average person, the average driver. So let's just say for the sake of argument, and we're just going to leave really high MPG vehicles out of this because they would be hybrids and electric cars, which would mean that they're going to face another fee on top of the gas tax that they already pay. So we'll just look at, roughly somewhere around the average person. So let's just say you have a car that has a 20-gallon tank. That's pretty close to around average. And let's say you go through maybe a tank a week. I think that most people would say that you go through about a tank a week. I mean, I'd say that's pretty fair. All right. So if you're using about 20 gallons of gas a week, that comes out to about $104. That's almost double. I mean, it's just barely shy of double what they're telling you it's going to cost. Oh, and by the way, that's assuming you don't take any special trips. So this is just your routine. If you're just using a tank of gas a week, going to work, going to church, whatever else it is you want to go to, lowballing it as much as I could and giving a conservative rate, I still wound up with about $104. And so I really do not understand where Senator Clyde Chambliss, who, by the way, is my senator, gets off going out and co-sponsoring this bill, telling people, oh, it's only going to cost you $55 a year. Not unless you're only using 10 gallons of gas a week. I mean, I'm using really conservative figures, and I didn't even use my own truck because I know that it gets very poor gas mileage. And just looking at the average vehicle, the average driver in the state of Alabama, there's no way it costs $55 a year. Absolutely no way. You can't figure it up in such a way to come to that conclusion without seriously fudging the numbers. And this brings me to my next point, which is gas taxes tend to hurt the poor the most. It's one of the reasons that I really oppose a gas tax, is because out of all the people that it affects, it hits the poor and it hits working people. Because if you're not working, you probably don't drive very much. I mean, you might have to go to a few places a week. Maybe you work from home and don't have to drive that much. But as a general rule, working people, the people that commute every day, the people that have to drive to work, that's who this hits. it doesn't necessarily hit the people that are super wealthy. It doesn't necessarily help the people or hit the people that are not working for whatever reason, whether they're on welfare or unemployment. It hurts the working people the most. And that, to me, is what's so distasteful about it. And another thing, too, it really hurts rural Americans. So if you're in the state of Alabama, which, let's be honest, it's not exactly a metropolis. Most of the state is pretty rural, pretty out in the boonies. And I happen to be a country boy myself, so I'm not making fun of those people. I'm just saying that if you live in that area and you have to drive, you know, 20, 30 miles into work every day, and yes, I know people that do that. I know people that drive a lot more. That is really going to hammer you. I mean, if you're going through a couple tanks of gas a week, that is really going to hit home. And this is one of the reasons that I really hate the way that they've set this tax up. And Senator Chambliss also claimed that after the increase, we would still have the lowest cumulative tax burden. There's only one problem with that. Now, granted, I realize the average person doesn't have access to the information that I do. Because I am a news personality, I know how to research. So after doing approximately 7, maybe 8 seconds of research, which, I mean, really tired me out, and using a super secret software program that I use, Google, I was able to find out that this claim is anywhere close to true. In fact, not only would we not have the lowest cumulative tax burden after this tax, which is what Senator Chambliss was claiming, we don't even have the lowest cumulative tax burden now. WalletHub has us at, I think, 8th. And granted, they weren't counting the gas tax at all. They were just counting our tax burden with, I think, property, sales, and income. But then I also looked at Forbes, which looked at a more comprehensive, and they had us as the 12th lowest. Now, don't get me wrong. As far as taxes go and comparing us to other states, being 8th and 12th isn't bad. But it also means that what Senator Chambliss is saying isn't anywhere close to truth, because those statistics were taken before this gas tax was even added. So not only would we not have the lowest cumulative taxes after this passed, we didn't even have it before they passed. So I don't know where Senator Chambliss is getting his information, but he's straight up lying to the public. Or he is woefully misinformed and didn't even bother to double check his research. Because like I said, this took me all of about 60 seconds of research to find out, yeah, there's no truth to this claim whatsoever. We don't even have the lowest cumulative tax rate now, much less after this gas tax is put into place. So this brings me to another sort of big question about this bill, which is, what about infrastructure? How do we know that this is going to go to infrastructure? Because that is the whole purpose of this thing. That's how this bill has been sold to us, is that we do have a real problem with infrastructure in the state. We really need to figure out a way to fix our roads and bridges. By the way, not arguing that point. I do think that we need to improve our infrastructure as much as possible. And I think that we should find economic ways to do that. So I don't know of anybody that's saying, no, we don't need new roads. We don't need new bridges. Everything's fine. But the question is this the best way to fund it? And another big question, which is the one that I'm going to try to dig into right now, is how do we know that this money is going to go towards infrastructure? Well, according to an inquiry done by our news partners over at WSFA, the legislators said that there is a provision that the Alabama Department of Transportation has to report back to them directly on how the money is spent. Okay, so essentially, your brilliant idea to make sure that the money doesn't go to the wrong place is to put it in the hands of the House and the Senate. That the Department of Transportation has to go back and report to you how the money is spent, so that'll ensure that there's no way that this money gets spent on anything else. That doesn't make a lot of sense for a couple of reasons. First of all, reporting back doesn't ensure anything. I mean, theoretically, the Alabama Department of Transportation could come back to the Senate and the House and say, yeah, we didn't spend a dime of it on roads. Now, that reporting back is really following the letter of the law, if that's what is in the bill. If that's the provision that they put in place, then all they have to do is report back. Doesn't mean they have to report back they spent it all on infrastructure. Just means they have to report back. And that's the oversight that's being given. Another reason that doesn't make sense is that you're saying that the legislature, they're the ones that are going to hold the Department of Education or the Department of Transportation's feet to the fire and make sure every dime of this money goes for infrastructure. Yeah, the big problem with that is that currently $63 million of the revenue that is gained from the current gas tax, not the new one, the old one, $63 million of that money is going to things other than infrastructure, going to things other than roads and bridges. So considering that it was the Alabama legislature that allowed that to happen, and they're the ones that are supposed to be the watchdogs over the Department of Transportation and make sure they don't spend money anywhere else. That doesn't sound like a real good plan. In fact, it kind of sounds like you've got the cat guarding the canary. The legislature is the reason that we don't have that $63 million having gone to roads and bridges. And now you're telling us that this new tax that you're gathering, the way that we're going to keep that tax from being misspent is that they're the ones that are going to oversee how it's spent. Oh, well, that makes sense. And here's another big problem with that, too. It was very possible that the legislature could have put into this bill whatever they wanted, including a provision that ensured and earmarked this money specifically to infrastructure. And if that's the case, if they had that option, why didn't they do that? Let's think. Why on earth would they not want an actual law on the books that says that's exactly where this money is going, it's not allowed to go to anywhere else? Why would they do that? Here's why. Because they don't want to go to jail. Because they have every intention of spending this money on something other than the gas tax, and they know it. And that's why they didn't put that provision in the bill. The only oversight in this bill is that they're going to tell people when they're spending the money right and wrong. It's not illegal to spend it on something else. It's just they have to report back to them. So essentially, they intend to use this money for other things. And because they don't want that activity to be illegal or cause them to go the way of Mike Hubbard or our former governor, and they don't want to go to jail for that, they want to put this provision in to where the only oversight is they have to basically look over it. Well, I mean, you can look over anything. I mean, that would be like if you were a police officer, say, well, the way that we're going to make sure that laws are enforced is there'll be a police officer present. Well, a police officer present means he could watch a crime occur and doesn't do anything about it. There's a reason the law actually has some teeth into it, and there has to be something on the enforcement side of that for it to make a difference. So it looks like we have a caller waiting on line four, so we'll go ahead and go straight to the phones. Good evening. What's your name?
Hey, this is John. How's it going?
Doing good. How are you?
Yeah, just wanted you to weigh in on an alternative solution to the dilemma that we find ourselves in. What would you have done with the obvious issue that you agree with? You agree with having infrastructure problems, and you don't have to do anything but drive through remote areas in Elmore and Coosa County to find that they're roads and bridges that certainly have big problems, and we have to do something about that for safety and for commerce too. So what would you have suggested as a way of getting more revenue for it?
Well, first of all, I think that the priorities are somewhat backwards, and I 100% agree with you. Like I just said, I really do think that we need more roads, more bridges. We need to repair the ones that we have. I don't even necessarily know that we need more ones. We just need to make sure that the ones we have are up to code, or else, you know, we turn into Mississippi. So I think that most people would agree that we need that. The way to solve that problem, though, is to cut waste internally, because like I just pointed out, approximately $63 million of the money that is currently brought in by the gas taxes we already have on the books is not going to roads and bridges. And that's a start. You could also cut several different government agencies. There's a number of bureaucrats that you could either age out and basically offer them a buyout to their contract and downsize the size and scope of government. But specifically that $63 million, that would be the first thing that I look into. Why is this money being diverted to other agencies other than the Department of Transportation? And another thing that I think that would also be helpful, I don't know that it pertains specifically to state highways, but I do think that the first burden of maintaining a bridge or a road is at the local level. Obviously, there's some things you can't do with an interstate or a state highway, but you've got to keep the primary, in my opinion, you've got to keep the primary responsible at the local level, because they'll spend the money most responsibly, because they know the roads that are used most often and the ones that need the money the most. In other words, the ones that are in the most disrepair. So that's just a couple of solutions that I would have offered.
Well, the thing I do agree with you on for certain is, of course, there's misuse of funds. I don't think there's any question about that. And I think that, the people that are paying for it the most are the middle-class people, like the ones that always get hit with taxes.
Always.
Because this thing is going to hit rural people, like you said earlier, much more give them much more of a hardship than it will either people on the other end, mm-hmm. or the deal with it, because you're still only able to use a certain amount of gas. And one thing businesses are going to do is pass on to the customer, too, so there's a residual impact, too, from this, because business owners, when they sell a product or service, whatever it may be, they're going to pass that on, too. So it always doubles up the amount of taxes it was going to be originally, and that's one of the things that needs to be talked about, too, as far as, you mentioned a couple of $100, probably at least $100 for each additional person right. that utilizes the gas. But it's also going to be more for people in another way, in another form.
Right, and that's the thing that a lot of people don't consider. There will be some things that may not see an increase, but just about every good that you use, it had to be transported some kind of way. If you're buying something on Amazon, that's going to be reflected in the delivery fee. If you're buying something at Walmart, I mean, that product had to get there some kind of way, which means that there was a trucker who had to pay more for his gas to get here. So, I mean, it's going to be very hard to measure that, but you are going to see an increase in prices across the board. Even if it's a very small amount, it is going to cost you more than just the direct taxes, which is a good point.
Well, what's the tax increase would you have given?
You mean the form of increase or the amount?
I mean, the form. What would you have done as opposed to gas?
No, actually, I think that the gas tax is a correct way to fund roads and bridges. I think that it makes sense that, I mean, if you're going to figure out a way to fund that particular type of infrastructure, the people that are going to be using it ought to pay for it. And the best way to do that is through a gas tax. So I'm not even opposed to using a gas tax increase. My problem is they did the increase before trying to cut spending, trying to cut waste, and they did it while there's still waste on the books from the current gas tax. And the specific provisions in this particular bill are really bad. There's essentially no oversight, and it was rushed through faster than the flash on a Coke binge. I mean, they pushed this thing through in 3 days.
Yeah, and the so, government new things that the government's good at doing. First of all, they're good at, the military's good, wildlife conservation's good. There are right. other folks too, but the best thing is wasting money. They're better at wasting
excellent
money
at that.
Than any other part or component of the government that they use. All of us have seen it, and in education, with my experience with that,
right.
a lot of it we didn't have any control over.
Well, that's true, and that's the same way I'm sure it is in any department. For example, if you're a guy working on construction in the Department of Transportation, they're not exactly asking those guys how to save money.
Yeah.
And so it's the same way over there. Unfortunately, they would probably gain a lot of insight into how to save money if they ask those questions. But you're right. The government is just, they're an expert at that. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. All right. So John from Millbrook there. There's a couple other things, a couple other moving parts that I want to unpack about this gas tax. And I think that that was actually a pretty good segue in it, because the main thing is we've looked at the bill itself and what exactly it was going to do. I'd like to really take a look into how a government that is sort of stereotypically moving at a snail's pace, how did they get this thing through in 3 days? How were they able to fast track this thing so quickly through the legislature in a special session? How were they able to get it through when it usually takes them a month to get to do anything? Well, there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, the special session made it much easier to slip through. Because it was a special session, it was a special session specifically to deal with this issue, the way that the rules are structured, it actually made it a lot easier for this bill to pass. This bill essentially passed because Kay Ivey, I mean, she knew what she was doing. She could have waited a few days because, keep in mind, the regular session starts tomorrow, and this bill passed, I think, Thursday. So she would have only had to have waited a few more days for it to go into the regular session. Why did she call this special session just days before the legislature was supposed to meet? Because she knew that calling it ahead of time that way, the rules are structured in such a way that it makes it easier for that bill to pass. And she knew that. Although, based on the people that voted in favor of it, she really didn't have to. But nonetheless, that was done intentionally. And so that's one of the ways that it was able to sell through so quickly. And Senator Brubaker, I should say former Senator Brubaker now, and if anything, this gas tax is a glowing example of why we need him back. Senator Brubaker wrote a scathing rebuke on how this whole thing was handled in AL.com. And here's a couple quotes from it I just wanted to read. "I was in the legislature for 12 years, and I don't believe I've ever seen a display of political muscle quite like the one we saw last week, as the House leadership steamrolled the opposition and passed a major tax package in 3 days. I mean, you're talking about somebody that has been in the legislature for 12 years. He's not a newbie to this. He's a veteran, and he's saying in his time, which is over a decade, in the Senate, he's never seen anything rush through this quickly. That is an astounding statement coming from a former senator. And he says a little bit later, "The Speaker and Representative Poole showed that they can lead Republicans to water and make them tax. If you are a road builder, time should be very good, and perhaps more than anyone else, the Mobile Port Authority came away with an extra $11.7 million a year for at least the next 20 years. Not bad at all." See, this is another problem with government spending just in general. Now, you have the problem with waste that we've already been talking about, but this is really a problem with crony capitalism. And we all know that this is going on. We all know that Alabama for a long time, I love my state, but let's be honest, when you're talking politics, most of Alabama politics is a good old boys club and always has been. There are a lot of government contractors that get an awful lot of money from the state of Alabama when they spend this much. And the fact that they're getting all this new revenue on top of the waste that they didn't cut to bring it in just means that more of that is going to take place. And if you're a guy that runs a construction company or you're in charge of this, boy, times are good because you just drastically increased the amount of money, that pool of money that you have to draw from. And so this is one of the things that Senator Brubaker is pointing out. The lobbyists were all 100% in favor of this thing, and it makes sense because they're going to make a ton of money off of this new tax. So here's another thing that he pointed out. During the House debate, a Republican lawmaker pointed out, quote, "There's no one in this building asking us to vote no on this." He was right. The only people in the building were elected officials and lobbyists. Because this tax was rammed through in a hellfire hurry-up special session, the public never got a chance to see it, much less try and influence their representatives. That's just wrong. That's not, quote, playing the game the way the Republicans said they'd play it. I mean, Senator Brubaker is 100% right. And sort of the theme of this entire piece that he wrote was the Republicans, even if you agree with the gas tax, even if you think the gas tax is a good bill, the way that it was rushed through so quickly ought to be something that raises everybody's eyebrow. Everybody ought to be suspicious of that. And nobody should be in favor of the way that the bill was passed, even if you like the bill. The way it was passed and the way they were trying to skirt the rules and wirework their way around it, it is a really, really bad deal. It is a really terrible way to go about running the House and Senate. And especially considering the recent history of the state of Alabama, when you're looking at what happened with our Speaker of the House, with our governor, the corruption that unfortunately has plagued the Alabama political realm for a long time now. I mean, it's things like this that even though there's no signs of corruption so far, we can't confirm that, it reeks of it. It's not fire, but it's a heck of a lot of smoke. And you know what they say about smoke. So the idea that this thing is rife with corruption, probably not accurate, at least not yet. But the idea that because it was rushed through so quickly ought to make everyone suspicious that corruption will probably follow as a result of it, that's totally legitimate. And I would put down every dime that I have, which granted isn't much, but I would put down every dime I have that you are going to see some corruption cases come out of this bill. That the money it spent, the way that it was ran through, now they may not be able to nail anybody on it because, like I said, basically the only thing that's ensuring that the money gets spent on infrastructure is basically a pinky swear that the legislator gave to the citizens of Alabama saying, don't worry, we'll manage it, we'll look after it. That's about the closest thing to a guarantee that we have. So I don't know if you even could nail anybody on corruption charges for spending it on something else because there's nothing in the bill that mandates that that takes place. But the point is, even if you're doing it the legal way, you can grease a buddy's palms. If you have somebody in the road construction business, even if you do it legally, even if you do it properly through the bidding process, believe me, it is a good time to be a construction guy in the state of Alabama if you're doing government contract work. And I did just want to say this. Congratulations to Will Dismukes and Will Barfoot. I'm going to be very frank on this. I like Will. Will Dismukes, nice guy, interviewed him a couple times, wound up voting for him in the primaries and in the general. But I was skeptical. And the reason that I was skeptical is the same reason that you're skeptical when you go to a new restaurant. Not that you're not excited about it. Maybe you've heard great things about it from your friends, but let's be honest, you've never eaten there yourself. You don't know if you're going to like the food. And so because it's something new and fresh and something you're not really sure about, when Will Dismukes came in talking about being conservative and being responsible and actually reading bills before he voted for them, I wanted to believe him. I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt, but I was a little bit skeptical. He was saying all the right things, but how many times have we seen a conservative go into office and promise to be conservative, promise to be anti-tax, promise all these other things, and the second they get in there, they become swamp people? And yes, I'm looking at you, Martha Roby. Will Dismukes was a little skeptical of him at first. He was going in, he was saying all the right things, but I was like, I'm just worried that he's going to wind up becoming one of the establishment pawns. He is one of only 20 members of the House of Representatives to vote against this bill. So I just wanted to give you some applause. And also William Barfoot, who is not one of my representatives, but in the Senate, doing a great job over there, also voting against it. So, you know, I got to give props to them, a couple of local politicians that did the right thing and voted against this bill. If nothing else, just say, I haven't had time to read this thing, and I'm not voting on it until I read it, which was basically Will Dismukes' argument against it. I remember seeing a post from him not too long ago where he said, I don't feel comfortable voting for this thing because I haven't had time to look at it, read it, digest it, and make a decision on it, so I'm going to have to vote no. That's the attitude we should have. He's giving an example of the way that people ought to read bills. That when you have a bill, especially one that's going to cause such a massive ripple effect in the state, you're like, okay, I want to read it, look at every aspect of it, take a couple of days to digest, think about possible repercussions or unintended consequences, give me a chance to talk to my constituents and what they think about it, then I'll come back and make an informed decision. That is not the way that most of the representatives in the state of Alabama did it. The way that it happened is less than 24 hours before they voted for it, they slammed this thing down in the House and said, oh, you're going to vote in favor of this. And they did, and they passed it. And then the same thing happened in the Senate, and then the governor signed it into law, all in about 4 days' time. 3 to 4 days, based on how you measure time, but basically a four-day period is how long this thing took. And the way that you just rush that thing through before anybody really has a chance to digest it, that is a sign of corruption if I've ever seen one. Now, Governor Ivey offered a interview with WSFA. And as I've said before, Governor Ivey was the least conservative out of all of her primary candidates. You remember back when we were going through and interviewing all the different candidates? Of course, Kay Ivey refused to show up on my show. Everybody else did, but she didn't. When we were talking about that, I said back then, I don't hate Governor Ivey. She's a little bit of a mixed bag. She's not really fiscally conservative. She's not really super against new taxes. But, you know, she is conservative on some things. But I still said, even back then, she is by far the least conservative out of all four of the candidates that we have for governor on the Republican side. And I think, if anything, this proves it. So she gave a interview with WSFA, and in this, she said that she was asked about her concern from some of the freshman representatives and people new to the legislature, saying that they felt like this was being rammed down their throat and they didn't really have time to adequately prepare to vote for this thing. And her response was essentially, and you can go back and look at the interview. Unfortunately, I couldn't pull the video today for whatever reason. WSFA is super protective of their video and doesn't put it on YouTube, and so I couldn't pull it. But nonetheless, so what Governor Ivey wound up doing when asked about this is she said essentially, well, they weren't really encouraged to run if they weren't on board with the gas tax. So there you have the governor, arguably, even though I would say that the Speaker of the House may take this title, arguably the most powerful politician in the state of Alabama, admitting in an interview that if they were not on board with my agenda, they were told not to run. Or they, at the very least, were encouraged not to run. I mean, that stinks of corruption if I've ever heard it. And another thing, too, is that reporting later, talking to different members of the House and the legislature, also showed that they were not given a lot of support by the Republican Party unless they were on board with this tax. That ought to be startling to everybody. So this is really where my question comes down to. Why is it always the first instinct of Alabama lawmakers to tax? Why is that always the first instinct when the budget's a little short? Why is cutting not the first instinct? Why is eliminating certain state departments or certain regulations not the first instinct? Why is that always the first instinct? That's what I don't get. I mean, we live in a state that literally runs liquor stores, and we're not looking at getting rid of that before we say, yeah, we're going to do a 55% increase on gas taxes. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. Don't tell me there's not plenty of places to cut, plenty of places to trim down. And State Auditor Jim Ziegler, and it's literally his entire job just to look at where money is going and tell you where it's going into the wrong places. He opposed the gas bill. He opposed this tax. And it was for exactly this reason, that we have so much more room to cut, that there is so much wasteful spending, that going with your hand out to the Alabama taxpayer is an inappropriate way to handle this. So, I mean, that ought to be a big red flag right there, that your state auditor is saying, no, this is a really terrible idea. There's a lot more room to cut. We don't need to start asking for more money just yet. And I want you to think about it this way. In this past election cycle, which we all remember, it wasn't that long ago, Democrats essentially had three major talking points for their agenda. One was raising taxes. Check. They got that one. They just raised taxes. The second was a lottery. You remember Walt Maddox, who was running for governor on the Democrat ticket? He talked about a lottery. Lots of the Democrats that were running for the House and Senate, they were talking about a lottery. So that was another one of their big agenda items. So number two is the lottery. Well, Republican Senator, not Democrat Senator, Republican Senator Jim McClendon has already vowed to bring the lottery up tomorrow, day one of the session. He is saying it will be brought up, and he's already garnered some support for that. So we've got Republicans passing a tax increase. Now we've got Republicans calling for a lottery. And the third one was Medicaid expansion. And in an interview the other day, Senator Dick Brubaker said, this was on the radio, I believe this was with Del Jackson, if I'm not, yeah. He did an interview with Del Jackson, and he said this, quote, "The members of the Black Caucus that I've spoken to, and I spoke to several yesterday, are under the impression that they've got a deal." So why is this significant? Because he was saying this in reference to a Medicaid expansion bill. And there are already Democrats talking about this. We've got a Democrat representative who is drawing up measures for a bill right now, and there is a deal in the works between Republicans and Democrats to try to get Medicaid expansion. So right now, out of all three of the Democrats' big talking points for this past year in the election, the Republicans are actually the ones putting forward two of them, and it sounds like there is a deal between the Republicans and the Democrats on the third to expand Medicaid. Well, with Republicans like this, who needs the Democrats? The Democrats are getting seemingly everything they want out of a super-duper Republican majority in the House and the Senate and as a governor. I mean, Republicans don't just have control of the House and Senate like on the national level. The Republicans can do whatever the heck they want. Their numbers are so big in the House and the Senate. And yet, what they are doing is the Democrats' bidding. They're actually shoving through the Democrats' agenda items. So what was the point in voting for Republicans in the first place? Why did we elect all these Republicans if they were just going to be exactly the same as the Democrats? That's the question we really ought to be asking ourselves. All right, so we're going to go ahead and go to the chaplain's report. So I do want to preface the chaplain's report this way. Paul is talking to the churches at Galatia. And one of the things that he's discussing with them is he recalls that they had such a vigor that he appreciated about them. They had a real zeal to know God and to know the gospel. They wanted to learn about this Jesus person that Paul was teaching them about. There was a curiosity and a love for God's word that Paul saw in them and really, really wanted to take advantage of. And he did. I mean, there were several churches that were founded there in Galatia in part because of Paul's teaching. And here in this particular passage, when he's writing back to these churches that he helped establish, there's a bit of remorse because he's saying, I remember when you guys were so zealous for the gospel. I remember when there was a thirst for the gospel message and that you guys, even though I was telling you that there were some things in your life that you were going to have to change, some things that you were doing wrong, there was this zeal, this desire to embrace the transformative power of the gospel. And this was something that excited Paul and that he really admired in them. And unfortunately, he's saying this attitude isn't there anymore. And he brings up the reason why here in the book of Galatians, chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. Where he says, "Where then is that sense of blessing you had? For I bear you witness that, if possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. So have I become your enemy by telling you the truth?" And the reason I think that this is such a very powerful message by Paul is that these are not Paul's enemies. These are not people that Paul, at least on the surface, would have disagreements with. They were Christians just like Paul. And he's saying, guys, I remember when this was who you were. When you heard something coming from one of the apostles, you had a desire to do it. That you wanted to not just do it, you were excited and enthusiastic. And you wanted to dive in headfirst. And now, when I tell you that there are some things you need to correct, you're fighting me on them. You're saying, no, we don't want to hear it. Go somewhere else. One of the things that is a common theme throughout the Bible, and you'll see this a lot in the book of Proverbs, is that people that welcome criticism, welcome correction, welcome advice to try to take it into the system and really absorb it and figure out a way to make themselves better people, that's something that God loves in his children. because we realize that we're flawed human beings, that we're sinful, that our natures are not perfect, and our mind and our soul are unfortunately not where they need to be. And because of that, we have this spirit of wanting to be better. And this is something, unfortunately, that the Christians at Galatia had at one point, and Paul is saying, I really hate that that's not there anymore. He's saying that back then, you would have been willing to pluck out your own eyes if I asked you to. That's how committed you were to being obedient to God and bending your will to His. Even though Paul would never tell someone to actually do that, he's saying, that's the level of dedication you used to have. And now you're treating me like the bad guy because I'm trying to say, hey, there's some things that you guys are getting wrong and need to correct. And one of the big things that was going on at Galatia is that you had this fight between the Jews and the Gentile Christians, and they were fighting back and forth about whether the law is still in effect or these dietary laws, and Paul's trying to correct them on this, and he's saying, and all of you were giving me all kinds of negative feedback and saying that we don't want to hear it, we aren't comfortable with this message. He's saying, get back to the place that you originally were. And I think that this, of course, is written to several different congregations in Galatia, but this is a powerful message for us too. And the reason that I say that is, how many of us could say exactly the same thing about ourselves? How many of us, whether it's the scripture itself and using that as our measuring stick, which we absolutely should do, could look back and say, man, when I first started out, when I first obeyed the gospel, when I first came to know God and know Christ, I was so enthusiastic. I was so ready to do anything, go on a mission trip, teach the gospel to others, and now I've just kind of fallen into a rut. And now when somebody does try to correct me or tries to steer me in the right direction, I kind of bite back and lash out. That's not the attitude we're supposed to have. We're supposed to welcome this spirit of growth, and we're supposed to never be content with where we are now. That's what it means to be zealous, that while we're probably a lot better off than we used to be, while we're probably a lot closer to God than we used to be, we're never really satisfied. We never get to the point to where we say, yep, my relationship with God is going pretty good. I'm just going to kind of cruise from here on out. Nobody should ever get to that point, no matter how good you are. We should always welcome correction. We should always welcome people that are trying to lovingly help us improve ourselves, to strengthen our fellowship with our fellow man and with God, of course, as well. And when we have that attitude, when we welcome the work, when we welcome whatever it is, whatever challenge that God has ahead of us, that's when we're really starting to cook with grease. That's when we're really starting to spiritually grow. And I think all of us have a tendency to fall into this kind of rut, this kind of complacency that we think, you know, we're not really committing any quote-unquote big sins, and we've gotten a lot of the really obvious bad stuff out of our way, and so now it's just time for us to kind of relax and wait for the Lord to come back and go to heaven. We're soldiers on a battlefield. This is not a downtime for us. This is not something that you can just cruise. This is not something that you can just kind of sit back and wait. God has us here to work. God has us here because He wants us to be better people by living in this world and help make the world better around us. And that's the kind of zeal that Paul was looking for in the Christians at Galatia. And that's the same kind of zeal that our Father wants out of us. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.